This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk, your host. Today, I have really a great pleasure of talking to Kevin Baker about a new book of his called The New York Game, Baseball and the Rise of a New City. Anyone who knows me, who's listening, knows that I like baseball. I maybe would be considered obsessed with baseball at some point in my life or always. And Kevin, I would say you share some of my obsessions.
Certainly.
We've talked before both about baseball and about New York. Book is kind of perfect, you know, covering something that is really important to both of us. And it's just a terrific book.
Thanks so much, David. Thanks for having me on.
One thing I do want to ask you, because I know you weren't born and raised in New York. I remember that.
I was born in New Jersey, in Englewood, New Jersey. But we moved up to Massachusetts when I was 9 years old, almost 9 years old. And that was the perfect dream summer of the Boston Red Sox. And I probably would have become a Red Sox. I was a Yankees fan already, but I probably would have become a Red Sox fan were it not for the fact that my schoolmates called my favorite ball player Mickey Mantle. And that was just too egregious an insult to stand. So I stayed firm as a Yankees fan during all the so-called Horace Clark years up there. And they didn't start to win again until I came back to New York for school. But yeah, I loved growing up there. Fantastic place to grow up, Brockport, Massachusetts. Utterly terrific. But yeah, I spent that whole time rooting feverishly against Boston teams, which were pretty good in those days. So
that's true.
And, very frustrating.
Right. And the Yankees did go through that dark period, which most people today barely know existed in history. Yankees obviously have, there's a mixed view of the Yankees around the world, but, in New York for the most part, they are the team. Yeah. And then the Mets come up as number two. But really, this book is much more about the history of New York and the history of baseball. And you've done a really great job, I think, of weaving together the history of both. And that, I think that's really important, because it's not that baseball symbolizes, it's more that baseball is part of the culture. And the evolution of baseball coincides with the evolution of American culture and society.
I think that's very true, David. Baseball has been used, of course, as a symbol for pretty much anything and everything. People compared it to the clipper ships going around the world in the early days. You go around the bases. It's always symbolic of everything. But in the case of New York, it was real. It was one of the great meeting places in the city, where people of almost every background, almost every nationality, could come together on the playing field and play and compete and maybe brawl a little and make up with a few beers after the game. This was, one of several great meeting spots in this most multi-ethnic, multicultural of American cities, in what was fast emerging as one of the great cities in the world. And I say, too, almost in the sense that from early on, there were a lot of attempts to exclude people of color. And in that way, too, it reflected the greatest tragedies of American life, specifically that sort of stubborn racism that goes on to this day. But it really was in the warp and woof of the city. The early teams came out of, very often came out of volunteer fire companies, which were kind of performance of themselves in the streets. They would go and they'd rush out to the fire, hauling their fire engines through the streets. They would fight with other fire companies over who was going to control the hydrant. And then the crowds gathered, and it really was almost like a ball game. You had vendors singing little ditties about buying their food and buying a you know, a good swig of dram. You had what were called fire tenors who would go and sing. Little boys worshiped the firemen. They'd buy them things like lanterns for their engines. And this evolved very quickly into political culture, political clubhouses. And, you know, Boss Tweed came out of a couple of different fire companies that he ran. And then to ball teams. You can really trace it. The very first openly professional team in a major league from New York, the New York Mutual, was owned by Boss Tweed and came from the Mutual Fire right. Company. So this was very specifically really part of New York culture.
Well, and also what I thought was interesting is that you can't talk about baseball or New York without talking about the rest of the country at the same time. You know, that New York has a place in, especially in the 19th century, but into the 20th century as the kind of, you know, the growth city, the leader of the city, you know, of the country socially, economically. But you have to end up talking about other parts of the history of baseball. So you end up with, you know, I know you talk somewhat about, you know, the touring team, the Cincinnati Red Stockings, you know, in the 1860s. But, you know, you cover a lot of ground and you did a really good job, I think, of keeping this narrative moving. I the word I kept thinking of was rollicking, you know, that you know, you're on the deck of the ship almost, you know, everything is just, you're moving forward, but that you know, the waves are taking you in lots of different directions. It's like a, you know, the growth of America through that period is, or let's say 150, maybe now almost, well, 200 years of history, basically. There's just so much that happens, and you didn't leave out very much. And so, but I thought it was very important to kind of place baseball in the social sphere, political sphere, as you did, talking about how it was a white game that we, you know, that was at least publicly celebrated. It's not that black people didn't play, but they played separately. And through economic challenges and difficulties that have been documented in other, you know, in other books. But then, you know, then there's a, you know, the Hispanic culture also gets, you know, included in this story, not just in New York, but elsewhere, because baseball becomes this international game. And as it is today, even more so. But so one question I had was, the book pretty much ends with World War II, just before what we might call the modern era. I assume you might have been tempted to keep going.
Oh, I did. there is a book too, which is written. It needs to be edited with a power saw, or something of that magnitude. But it is it has been written, needs to be edited, and will be out in the spring of 2026.
Oh, fantastic! So,
I initially submitted this obscenely long manuscript, and my editors were sort of baffled by this. And, you know, I submitted this in August of 2020, and they kind of looked at this for a while and then finally decided, okay, we'll make it two books. Wow. I think it was my agent's suggestion. So that was an excellent idea. And we decided to cut it at the end of World War II, because not only is this a crucial pivot in New York City's history. It's when New York emerges from the World War, the only major city in the world, really, that has not been bombed or occupied. But also, this is the moment when Branch Rickey is about to sign Jackie Robinson as the first black player since 1884. In the major leagues, and the first black player since 1898 in so-called organized white ball. And that's a really seminal moment, which comes about in part because of Rickey's desire to do it, in part because in New York you have a very liberal Republican governor named Tom Dewey, who gets passed the first state anti-discrimination law in the United States. And I know that's hard to believe now, a liberal Republican who passes anti-discrimination laws, but there it was. And this leads to all kinds of changes going forward. So the second book will go from the end of the war to the present day.
Yeah. No, I think that makes sense. Yeah. And I mean, and also because, you know, World War II is not only a pivotal moment, in that sense, I have this book that I've kind of cleaved to for years by Andrew Hacker, who taught at Columbia. It's a book about how World War II is this sort of pivotal time in the history of American culture, because prior to World War II, most Americans lived in one place. And it's not that they didn't move around, but most Americans lived in one place and stayed there. And World War II made a melting pot in a more meaningful way. It changed history. People who were, from South Carolina spent time with people from New York, and they went all over the world. They in the Army and the Air Force and the Navy, it just disrupted all of the existing social connections. So World War II is really a perfect moment to break a story, because it is a big break in the way that, American society functioned and became more worldly too.
Very, very much so. Yeah. And New York too was the big world war, was the big war city really in America. The Brooklyn Navy Yard outproduced, in terms of ships, outproduced the Empire of Japan. One Navy Yard by itself, a huge amount of the goods and the soldiers and the sailors for the war went through the port of New York. My father remembers watching, you could see these convoys, gigantic convoys, lining up in the Hudson River, kind of turning around and heading out to sea. So at the end of this, New York really emerges pretty triumphant. Among other things, there are a million manufacturing jobs in New York City alone. And this will be, it's really sort of the world leader, if only by default, in everything, in finance and manufacturing. All of that's going to change and change pretty rapidly in many ways. But it's this sort of crowning moment. And it's a great middle class city, because it was probably run better than it had ever been under LaGuardia, who comes in 34, is still considered the greatest mayor in American history. And a lot of things are really done to make middle-class life working-class life much better than it had been in the city. And one of those things includes you could go see three of the greatest baseball teams ever for next to nothing.
Right.
It's not, I was looking at how much it costs to go see the Knicks in the series. It's something like $700 people were spending ball game. I'm a Knicks fan, but I don't care if Willis Reed came back from the dead and hit the game winning shot. I'm not going to pay $700.
And that's just the minimum. There are people spending thousands. No, baseball in New York. I mean, I guess we should talk about this a little bit, because, it's not all about the Yankees. It's Brooklyn as a city on its own for a big chunk of that time, and then the Giants playing in Manhattan, while the Yankees are playing in the Bronx. So there are three boroughs which each have a team. And I love, there was a lot that I didn't know about in terms of the development and early history of the Dodgers and of the earlier history of the Giants. I mean, I knew a lot about, McGraw, but prior to that, there's a lot that I didn't know about. So, and just ownership issues, the whole thing with the Stonehams and, there was a lot that you include here that I learned about. which I thought was terrific.
Thanks.
And, you know, it's sort of the whole issue of building a stadium in the city. I had not even really thought about that. It's, you know, finding land and building the stadium it's a big deal. Now, although it was really interesting how fast they were able to build a stadium in those days compared to what it would be like today.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and of course, I don't think there was public financing at the level, you know, which is that great, you know, in a lot of ways. And there's a book about this I know I've read, but I can't remember the name of, which is essentially documenting the theft of the public by the ownership of baseball teams and other sports teams as well, essentially convincing everyone that this was a good thing for all of us when it's really just a good thing for the ownership.
Oh, it's terrible. Yeah. It's terrible how cities have fallen into that trap, particularly cities that are not doing well. I mean, places like Detroit and Cleveland have spent literally billions, have spent $2-3 billion in subsidies for all their, you know, keeping their teams there for the last 20 years, building and rebuilding stadiums. And it's obscene in New York too. The Yankees have received two heavily subsidized stadiums. The last one, I think, cost $1.2 billion in total taxpayer subsidies. And in return for this, they have reduced the capacity of Yankee Stadium. The original Yankee Stadium, by the 1930s, with standing room, you could fit about 82,000 people in that. The current one seats about 46,000. In other words, right, you've removed basically the equivalent of Fenway Park from Yankee Stadium, despite these huge subsidies. The Mets have also reduced the size of their stadium and got similar percentage-wise, similar subsidies to what it cost. And they removed these seats to put in luxury boxes. So you have these two very corporate entities making money hand over fist and getting enormous public subsidies to do it, despite constantly restricting the ability of the average New Yorker to get in and see these teams. It's a ludicrous way to do business. And much as how baseball operated was very tied in with the political economic culture of New York in the 19th century, this is very tied in with the political economic culture of New York now, which is over and over again all about subsidizing what are already the wealthiest and most powerful people in the city.
And right. Although it is also fair to say that at least in the past, sports teams, especially baseball teams, were not always owned by billionaires or the multimillionaires of their era. So that, you know, that some of the owners of teams that you talk about were people who kind of hard scrabble brought themselves up from nothing. Not to say they didn't make, you know, let's say, connections that were valuable to them along the way, but it wasn't as if they made $1 billion or $5 billion in finance and then went and bought a team. These, and most of them had to run the team as a business,
yes,
in a way that would support them, you know, maybe unfairly, but still, it was not the playthings of the rich and famous, as it is.
Yeah. Oh, very true. And I'm no apologist for Tammany Hall, which for the most part was a terrible exploitive organization and one that really had become, really should have been done away with long before it was. It really had become this sort of predatory political machine. But they didn't give away billions of dollars to build stadiums. And if you offended them in some way, or even if you didn't pay off, or they just felt like it was time to expand the city up where your ballpark was, they might run a street through it. has happened a couple times. It's happened with the original Polo Grounds, happened with the Yankees' first stadium, Hilltop Park. They would just, you know, sorry, too bad, bye-bye, move on. And these, it was more than coincidence that a lot of the early New York ballparks ended up in some of the most fetid marginal places in the city, former garbage dumps. Ebbets Field was built on what was called Pig Town. Polo Grounds is built on land that had recently been raised from the bottom of the East River. Yankee Stadium and an old lumber mill. These were an old lumber yard. These were, this is how it operated. And there was something kind of good about that, that these owners had to go and do this. And some of them were admirable in some ways, like Charles Hercules Ebbets performed Herculean feats to keep, he came up from a scorecard seller and performed great feats to keep the Dodgers in Brooklyn when his co-owners wanted to move them to Baltimore. You had other people, you know, people like, you had people like John T. Brush, the Hoosier Wanamaker department store owner, who seems to have been a very nice guy who ran the Giants for years. On the other hand, you had kind of little monsters like the Stonehams running the Giants. The elder Stoneham, Charlie Stoneham, may actually have killed two women to get hold of their financial portfolios during his time as a bucket shop operator on Wall Street. And then you had people like Colonel Rupert, the main owner, Colonel Jacob Rupert of the New York Yankees. And I think he's the most transformational sports owner in history, in that he really is the guy. He comes out of Tammany's connections too. He was a Tammany congressman for 8 years. They wanted to make sure to get the German vote. He had a German accent despite being born here. Inherits a brewery, which is nice work if you can get it, and hits on the synergy of, I'm going to have a ball team too. And he loved baseball, though. He buys up the Yankees, but he starts to run them as a corporation with strict boundaries on who has what powers in the corporation. The general manager, Ed Barrow, didn't go on the field where Miller Huggins was in charge. He builds this whole network of scouts and farm teams. And he keeps putting money back in the team, back in the business. He was a rather cold, ruthless individual, but he at least ran his business the way businesses should be run, as opposed to the people running the Dodgers and the Giants, who became sort of more and more selfish and ended up moving the teams out of the city in what was a horrible move in the 50s. But Rupert really makes, and he makes the Yankees big time, the way sports hadn't been. You know, it's we know, all everybody knows the story of Harry Frazee, the notorious Broadway producer who owned the Red Sox and sold not only Babe Ruth but half his team to the Yankees. That was because Broadway was a much better investment than baseball at the time. A lot of people would be stunned to hear this, but baseball basically made about what the sheet music industry made in terms of profit by about 1920. Broadway, you could make much more with a hit show, but that was all about to change, in good part thanks to Jacob Rupert, and it would never go back.
Right. No, I thought that was also kind of revealing to me how baseball, even though it was the most popular American sport, was still kind of small time for a long, you know, well into the 20th century. And that, as you pointed out, Rupert and the Yankees were the first team to professionalize it into a business and, you know, almost single-handedly invented baseball as a modern business. You know, and I think it, you know, it's less romantic, but it also does create the groundwork for what we have today. Now, that could be questioned, you know, whether this is all better than what it was. And the, you know, how sustainable is a, you know, as is it as an industry, I don't know. But it was really surprising at how small time they were. And even in their biggest years, most of the teams would draw relatively small numbers of fans. And as you pointed out, not paying that much money to get in.
No.
So of course, not paying that much money to the players either. And another thing that, you know, you remind us of is how hard the players worked in this period. Even Babe Ruth, forced to barnstorm essentially to make his, even though he was the best paid player in history at that time, all those players were barnstorming and playing extra games even during the regular season, which is like mind-boggling to think about.
Oh yeah.
That's a great part of the story. I remember I've read a little bit about George Weiss in New Haven, because you know that's I live around New Haven, and he came from Yale and started by running a minor league team, which he eventually turned into a team he owned. And there was, they couldn't play baseball in New Haven on Sundays because of the blue laws. So he put his team just outside the city limits at Lighthouse Point. And there is, he brought Babe Ruth and, you know, Tris Speaker and all these other 1920 stars came and played in New Haven, and they could come on a Sunday when they couldn't play anywhere else.
Very much so. And that was something that Hal Chase, who is plays a prominent role in this book too, used to do. He was a completely corrupt character, probably the most corrupt ball player ever, but very hard to catch at throwing games, in part because of the subtlety of baseball, how easy it is to do that. Also, in part, because he played constantly. He'd go over to, you know, go over to Newark or someplace else in New Jersey and play a game on the Sundays off. New York also, at that point, did ban Sunday baseball until Jimmy Walker gets it changed in about 1920. Was he throwing games or was he simply exhausted? He probably didn't know himself at the time. But this was how small baseball was. And with Ruth coming in too, this is the man and the time and the place being met completely, because Ruth is far and away the biggest attraction. He's an attraction unlike anything we really know as a ball player today. And everybody wants to see him play. He's transforming the game at a moment when it's at its lowest level. He comes into New York. The Yankees at this point are at such a low ebb that they're still renting space from the Giants in the Polo Grounds. He draws the first ever million fan gate for the Yankees in 1920. And I think Ruth, just as Rupert was really the most transformational owner, I think Ruth is really the most transformational athlete ever. Obviously, there are a number of other athletes who are better known worldwide. Michael Jordan, Pelé, and half a dozen other soccer players, LeBron, Muhammad Ali. But Ruth was really the guy who takes baseball big time, which is the first American professional sport to go big time, and the world sort of follows, which was to me interesting to realize. And there were a number of other things like that. I was surprised to find out that, as far as I can tell, and I'm not saying this is conclusive or anything, but I think the first ever sports league was a professional baseball league. The National Association in old Major League in 1871. I cannot find any record. There weren't European soccer divisions before this. I can't find any record of any league anywhere. I could be wrong, but this is very interesting, as opposed to just teams sort of challenging each other and barnstorming. You had a league, and this leads to the long season. Another thing that's intriguing is you have another kind of evolutionary branch that almost was, but got cut off. The players rebel and form the Players League in 1890, and they mortally wound one of the two existing major leagues, and they almost do in the other one. And that's intriguing to think too. What if pro sports leagues had all grown up owned in good part by the players? How different that would have been in American life.
Possibly, although remember that in the movie business, when the stars got together and created their own studio, it morphed fairly quickly into being like a regular business.
United Artists.
And, well, you never know. I mean, I always wondered about that, you know, when I read early history of baseball. The Players League was always interesting to me. And then the Federal League, which was subverted, basically. You know, that you wonder what would have happened if it had, you know, we didn't have just two leagues and there were only eight teams in each league. And for like 50 years, there were no team west of the Mississippi. You know, there were all these, you know, kind of what if things that the, you know, that why was the power of baseball stuck in the East Coast and, you know, the growing West Coast, which had the Pacific League, which was almost as good as the American League or National League, you know, in its heyday. It's just so interesting.
No, as you say, the Pacific Coast League often had guys who were considered to be major league level, and they just simply didn't want to leave California, and who would, you know?
Right, I know. You play all year round.
Yeah.
You talked about Yankee, well, all the major league teams had to do spring training in the North during World War II. Yeah. That was, oh my God, you know, can you imagine spring training in Atlantic City? That sounds like fun.
Yeah. the wife of one of the Dodgers owners used to play the piano to entertain the players afterwards, and they were a bunch of them were so young in World War II that they the Dodgers actually had a 16-year-old infielder at one point, and the players were so young that there were requests for candy to the traveling secretary, which he said he had never gotten before. You
know? Well, you know, I think the youngest player in the major leagues in history was Joe Nuxall, who played for the Reds during World War II as a 15-year-old.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and he was not allowed to, you know, no bars for him.
Right. Yeah. No, it was funny that it was a crazy. And, you know, yeah, it's, wow, I would have loved to have seen a Players League take off. We have to be careful. They weren't especially virtuous. The man who put it together, fascinating character named John Montgomery Ward, who was not only a star pitcher and then shortstop and a lawyer in the offseason, but he wanted to integrate the Players League.
That's right.
He was shot down by his fellow players who also did not want it. So it wasn't only the bosses. It was also...
Racism was absolutely a factor in in American life in a really big way. And, you know, to imagine that the North was immune from racism is, you know, impossibly silly.
Yeah.
There was the first baseball novel was written by a guy who was a professor named Bliss Perry, written it in 1895, called The Plated City. And it is about race and class in baseball. And he talks about, you know, the frustration of black players that they could not play baseball with, you know, in the mainstream. Yeah. And that was, you know, it was known. It wasn't like it was like or not. It was an active part of American society.
It was and a great shame. And it was, you had... up to 1898, you had 55 known black players in so-called organized white ball, despite tremendous harassment. You had a couple of major leaguers up until 1884, and they were just systematically run out of the game. And then the color wall went up where they would not let them play. And, this was a terrible thing for them. It was a terrible thing for all of us. It was, you have all these sort of debates about, well, was baseball as good, you know, back when you didn't have, when you had this segregation and all this. But beyond whether it was good or better or worse, it was just horrible morally. It was a terrible thing in that sense.
And it was a wrong that took a long time to be corrected. And it's a shameful part of American history that we just have to acknowledge and recognize that, we've come a long way, but we still have a ways longer to go.
Yes. Yeah. It's always.
I think only the last thing I want to say is that even if you don't love baseball, I think this book is really worth reading. But if you do love baseball and you really don't know New York, this book is really going to open your eyes. It's like, and even if you love baseball and you love New York and you think you know everything about New York, you're going to learn something from this book because there's just so much in it that just, it's mind-boggling. So I want to give you credit for an amazing amount of research, but also the writing is terrific. You move the narrative forward with a lot of energy and balancing mini balls in the air. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you, David. It's been a delight to talk to you.
It's always fun to talk to you, Kevin, and thank you for doing this. This is David Wilk. I've been talking to Kevin Baker about the New York game, baseball, and the rise of a new city. This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors, and thank you for listening.